In this weekend's episode, The Washington Journal explores the Library of Congress's Music Division and the role music has played in American history and culture, from the country's founding to today.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Joining us for the discussion, Art the Chief, Susan Vita, and the Head of Reader Services, James Wintle.
What is the music division here at the Library of Congress?
So the music division is a really rich and vibrant part of the Library of Congress. If you would think of the Library of Congress as probably the largest public library in the world, the music division is a library within that library. It's probably as big as a large city public library. We do all of the things that a regular library does, and I'll get into that in a minute. But let's talk a little bit about how we started. The Congress had a library back in 1812 when the British burned the city, using the books from the library to help start the fire. And afterwards, 2 years later, Thomas Jefferson convinced members of Congress to purchase his library. His library had 13 books on music in it. That was the start of the music division in the Library of Congress. And why Jefferson made the argument that there's nothing that the citizens of the United States would be interested in that shouldn't be in a congressional library. Because before, it was a legislative library. It was all about the laws. It would compare the laws of France and Italy and whatever. So it branched out at that time. And at first, it started slow. And then in 1870, the copyright law was changed. And no longer were copyrighted works deposited in the states. They were to come to the Library of Congress. And there is a photograph that we have which shows a piano in a big room full of books that are piled up.
And we're showing this to our viewers right now.
Super.
It's from about 1900.
Yes. And
is this the music division?
This is the music division in 1900. The music division didn't actually exist until 1897. When they saw that and said that something has to be done. And if you think about it, music is like another language. And so they couldn't just give it to the normal people that took care of regular books in a library because they don't necessarily read music. And we had to have experts that were able to do that was their job. And so consequently, that's how the music division started. And I really think that Jefferson was prescient in deciding that he needed to convince Congress to look beyond just laws. Because if you think about how many things that we are dealing with today are talking about streaming and intellectual property rights and all of those things that affect music and the arts. And if we hadn't collected all of this and weren't interested in it, we would be doing a huge catch-up job.
So, Susan Vita, is every piece of copyrighted music in American history contained in the music division?
No, it isn't. We've made a decision as to which things are likely to be used for academic study and for the use of the American people. And so there are things like, for example, the books that you used when you were learning how to play a piano, the educational things like that, they won't be in the library. There will be maybe examples of them, but we don't keep everything. So no, the answer is no.
So how do you choose which pieces to include in the music division's collection?
Well, it's a process based on what we use in the reading room and what people tend to come in looking for. We have certain parameters that we deal with. It's called a collection policy that includes certain types of material that we choose to catalog. And there's a distinction actually to be made in that when pieces are deposited through the Copyright Office, they're all kept at this point in history. They're all kept, and some of those are cataloged and made part of the permanent collection, and others are stored in an offsite facility under their copyright number. So those things are still accessible. As far as the sort of breadth of American history goes, that has not always been the case. There have been points where only title pages of books were part of the deposit agreement. So when the copyright deposits were being taken to state, sort of central state locations, that was a point in the 19th century when there were only title pages. So those full books weren't deposited in the first place. And then when it moved to be centralized in the Library of Congress in 1870, the law has changed over time about in regard to what kinds of things were deposited, how much, you know, how many copies, that sort of thing. So we keep most things, but some of them are cataloged and some of them aren't.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Susan Vita, how many audio recordings do you have in the library's collection?
Well, there's something that I have to say about that. The music division is not in the does not have a responsibility for sound recordings. In the 70s, the library made a decision to change the way they organized itself, and they went to a system where the format was important. So sound recordings are now the purview of the NAVCC institution, which is down in Culpeper. It's part of the Library of Congress. But I can answer the question approximately, but it's not under my purview. So about, I would say it's they have about 10 million items. We have, and this is not, I'm not, this is not a competition, but we've been in existence longer than they have. We have 25 million pieces in that are on paper. And we are in charge of notes on paper, and they're in charge of the sound.
Well, we are here to look at the arc and history of American music over the last 250 years. And we want to start by playing one of the oldest, or the oldest piece in the library's collection, and this is from the New England Psalm Singer. It's a piece called Chester, and the artists for this modern performance are Paul Hiller and His Majesty's Clerks. Take a listen. James Wintle, what can you tell us about what we just heard?
That song, Chester, is from a 1770 publication called the New England Psalm Singer. It was the first book that was published in the United States, the first music book published in the United States, that contained music entirely by a native-born composer. And William Billings was an interesting figure. He was born and raised in Boston, and the book was published there. And he was a singing school teacher. So he would basically teach the masses how to read music using a do, re, mi, so, fa sort of method for reading music, and would have these schools where he would basically teach psalm singing. And this particular book, The New England Psalm Singer, is interesting for a number of reasons. This particular piece, Chester, is one that has sort of captured the imagination of composers throughout American history. There's a very famous piece from the 20th century by a fellow named William Schumann, an orchestral piece called New England Triptych, that uses Chester as one of the movements. And there are a number of pieces throughout the history of American music that look back to William Billings as the source of their tunes. And that goes back to what I was saying about Rhapsody in Blue and the idea of sort of trying to find the Americanness in classical music. And William Billings was one of the sort of touchstones for composers that came later. He himself, as I said, was a music teacher, and was kind of a the way he's described physically, that, you know, one leg was shorter than the other. He had an eye patch. He was sort of this interesting looking guy who was a very prolific composer. And in this book, The New England Psalm Singer, he actually procured the services of a printer and engraver who was also in Boston by the name of Paul Revere, who people probably know from American history and riding horses around to great acclaim. And so Paul Revere actually engraved the frontispiece of the book. So there's on the front, sort of the front page before the table of contents, there's a circle with music and a picture of fellows sitting around a table looking at music sitting on the table, and the circular staff with music on it is actually a round that can be sung. And this part of the book was engraved by Paul Revere, and Paul Revere had at that point worked engraving music a few different times, but this particular piece is one of the most famous instances of Paul Revere sort of showing up in the music world.
Well, Susan Vita, this is from 1770. Let's use this piece to talk about copyright. Can anyone use that music for any purpose whatsoever at this point?
You know, I'm not a copyright expert, so I need to defer that. I think we need to it's a great question, and people should be really interested in in the answer to it, but I suggest that they go to the copyright, to the website, and look up the copyright office.
How often do you deal with those types of issues in your work?
Well, James is the one who would know that more because he works on the reference desk, but it's frequent, right?
It is. It's a daily, it's a daily event that someone will call in and ask about the copyright status of a work or ask about, one of the most common questions that we get is for a family who's cleaning out their, grandmother's attic or something along those lines, to come across a copyright notice that their relative has written a piece of music at some point in their lives, something that oftentimes they were never aware of, and will come to us and say, I have this copyright notice. Is there any way we can find this piece? It would mean so much to us. And those kinds of questions about accessing copyrighted material are extremely frequent. And usually every day someone will come in and want to copy something and say, is this okay? And we have to defer, of course, to the copyright law, and we have signs posted and that sort of thing.
Susan Vita, how large is your division here at the library, staff, budget, and how did you get into this business?
Well, it's the greatest job I've had. It is the largest music library in the world, we believe. We have a staff of around 70 people. And as I said, we do everything that any large public library would do. As I said before, we have about 25 million pieces. That includes notes on paper. It includes books and treatises about biographies, about composers, letters, correspondence, both business and personal. We'll have a letter from George Gershwin talking about going to a party, and that was to celebrate Moss Hart's new teeth when he was getting dentures, I guess. We have some wonderful correspondence that you'll find in there. Photographs, beautiful photographs of jazz musicians and, daily life. We have scrapbooks. One of the really cool scrapbooks that we have is from Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, and seeing them running around at the beach and that kind of thing. It's great. It's very varied, very rich, very. It's just a place where academics can come and use the material that we have to further their research, as well as, as James said, we will have people come in off of the street and say, can you help us find this, my grandmother's, whatever. That's a copyright question that we can answer if we have it. So at any rate, we also have musical instruments. We probably the most famous would be our Strad collection. We have six Stradivari stringed instruments. Another very famous thing that more recent is James Madison's crystal flute, which Lizzo played while she was here. And we have, Jerry Mulligan's saxophone, that kind of thing. We also collect ballet. We have Alvin Ailey's collection, and that's something I probably need to mention, and that is we've been talking about books, about things that you might find elsewhere or we might be unique because they're so old. But we branched out, I would say, mostly in the 20th century after the division was formed, and to do what we call special collections, which basically indicate we will take the papers of George Gershwin and Ira Gershwin, of Copland, of Leonard Bernstein. And so it's not, those are unique. You'll not find them anywhere else because there is only one of them. And we have about 600 different collections from different composers and artists in the music division, and the ability to dive into them is magical.
So how did you get into this business?
I got into the business by being a good manager. This is the sixth division that I have run. And
at the library?
At the library, yes. So I hope it wasn't because I was so terrible that they wanted to get rid of me.
Well, we're glad you're joining us on the Washington Journal here at the Library of Congress to talk about the history of American music. The numbers are up on the screen. You can go ahead and dial in. Between James and Susan, my guess is they could answer most everything about American music. 202 is the area code, 748-8000 for you in the East and Central time zones, 748-8001 if you live in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. We'll begin taking those calls in just a few minutes. But first, we're here to hear music. And the next piece we're going to hear is from Francis Johnson, and this is from 1818. James Wintle, that was a lovely piece from 1818.
Yeah,
what was that?
Really is. It's one of the it's part of a collection called New Cotillions and Dances by a composer named Francis Johnson, and that publication in 1818 was actually the first piece of music that was copyrighted by a black composer in the United States. And Francis Johnson was a really interesting figure. He lived in Philadelphia and was the leader of an extremely popular band that would play for social dances, and started what was known as the cotillion craze in Philadelphia during the first part of the 1800s. And it was interesting because there were integrated audiences going to these dances, listening to the Francis Johnson band. He would play for all kinds of different groups of people throughout the city. And his orchestra was made up of all of the best black musicians in Philadelphia at the time, and a number of them were composers as well. So the members of the band would also write pieces for the orchestra to play. And so there grew from this group a school of African-American composers who were all working in this sphere in Philadelphia, writing music together and being influenced by each other, and have a really quite an interesting group of compositions coming out of that city at that time. And Francis Johnson was such a famous figure that even after he died, a few decades after this was published, his band went on as Frank Johnson's orchestra, and they would still be performing under his name because his name was what would bring in the crowds. And today, you know, Francis Johnson is not a figure that is known in America, even among people who study American music, and was a really quite an important figure. So whenever I do a display at the library, I always like to pull this out because it is such an interesting time in American music, and he was such a pivotal figure.
Susan Vita, before we begin to take some calls, we should mention we're in the Coolidge Auditorium in the Jefferson Building at the Library of Congress. I will confess that I always thought this was named after Calvin Coolidge. It's not.
You're not the only one who thinks that. Yeah. In fact, it was Mrs. Coolidge was not, except maybe very, 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 very distantly related to Calvin Coolidge. She called herself the other Mrs. Coolidge. But she was an imposing woman and had an amazing influence on the music division and its growth and its history.
And this is Elizabeth Sprague.
Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge. Ooh. Yes, exactly. She came to the chief of the music division at that time and said she was somebody who loved chamber music, and she would have salons in her own home to have performances. But she realized, and she also was amazingly important in commissioning new works. She commissioned almost every important composer from the later half of the 20th century. We can talk about that in a minute. But so she went to the chief of the music division and said she would like to be able to create a concert series so that, and she would fund it so that it would live beyond her. The music division chief, of course, would not turn something like that down. However, he said, unfortunately, we don't have a venue to present such things. So she said, well, what if I supported the building of that? And of course, then that set into motion a very interesting and unusual thing, because at that time, a public individual could not give money to the U.S. government for such a thing. So there had to be a special bill, law passed, which was passed in January of 1924. That enabled us, and many, many donations after this, donations for people to be able to give money to the U.S. government. So I say that the bill was passed around the 28th of January, and the most amazing thing about the whole story, I think, is that the first concert was held, when do you think?
I would say a year.
It was in October of less than 9 months, back in the days when...
And this building already existed, and they had to...
No, this was a courtyard.
Oh.
And they put it right into the middle of the courtyard, and it is acoustically magnificent. It is one of the major venues for chamber music, you know, that exists today. It's a wonderful story. She was just a dynamo. She was 6 feet one, and she would go around in her motor car, and she was terrific.
Now, are there still music performances here in this room?
Absolutely. We have. We are about to celebrate our 100th year, starting next year. We will be 100 years for having a chamber music series here in the library, and you can find that online. But we have it. One of the, I think, really important things to understand is they are all funded with gift and trust funds that people have given us. None of that is from appropriated money. And every single concert is completely free. There are no charges for it.
And open to the public.
Open to the public. So it is world-class A-plus artists. We do about 40 concerts a year, starting in October, going through June. And I encourage you to check it out.
That was Susan Vita and James Wintle from the Library of Congress's Music Division. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.
If you've been enjoying this podcast on Stitcher, please be aware that platform is ending operations at the end of August. But don't worry, you can still find this podcast and all of C-SPAN's podcasts on many other podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and the C-SPAN Now app.